Blog Talk Radio.
Well, there's one way to start the afternoon. Welcome to Straight Talk Radio, where we discuss business, politics, culture, and local and world issues. It's our first live show here on July 3rd, and all of them are automatically saved into podcasts, which you can listen to at the site you're on right now. I'm your host, Donya Keating, coming in hot from Seattle area at 3 p.m. Pacific time. And listeners, if you're out there, aside from tuning in, you can use this podcast or the show live from your desktop, your laptop, or your tablet, or your smartphone, but you can also dial in and talk to us live at 646-378-0261. Again, that's 646-378-0261. Or you can fire up the chat, you know, straight from your desktop there, and we'll do our best to include your questions or your comments here. This afternoon, we've got Catherine Simpson out there, and she's our guest. We're going to talk about some of her work and her experiences, and whatever flows. We'll just have some fun with it. Good afternoon, Catherine. Are you out there?
I am. How are you?
Oh, great. Welcome. How are you feeling today?
I am doing great. It's really nice to be able to have the energy to enjoy the summer, and we'll probably get into a little bit about the background on that in a few minutes, but doing really well and just ecstatic to be out and about doing normal things.
Well, I can imagine, and it's absolutely great to have you here. So why don't we start off with you giving us a brief bio, some kind of a sketch of who you are.
Sure. I was actually born in St. Louis, Missouri. I moved out here when I was about 10 to the Kitsap Peninsula. Grew up here in local schools and in the local communities here between Port Orchard and Bremerton. And graduated from the University of Washington, have two wonderful children, and this has been home for 40 years. So that's my general background.
Okay. And many of us know you as a recently retired South Kitsap School District Board Director, and you've made some significant inroads for education as a strong advocate in your district, and you've done quite a few other things in the region here. So let's start with that. What are the top three decisions or accomplishments that you're most proud of when you were doing your board director work?
Well, thanks for the kind words about serving on the school board. I spent 8 years on the South Kitsap School Board, 3 as a school board president. And, I thought a lot about, what did I accomplish? I didn't accomplish a whole lot individually. We have in the district nearly 900 employees. They accomplish the work. What the role of the board is to set that vision and mission and expect it to be executed well. And so what I'm proud of has to do a lot with that execution. And first is, personally, I made an effort in every opportunity I had as a school board member to focus on student achievement. What are we doing that's in the best interest of our students and in their success? And I'm very proud that I kept that that mantra, that vision, forefront. So it wasn't about Kathy Simpson. It wasn't about my kids. It was about my kids and their 10,000 closest friends in South Kitsap schools. So probably the second thing, I'm very proud of the work that South Kitsap has been doing and that I was a part of, was our focus on the whole child. Well, there are lots of critics out there that would say that education is all about reading, writing, and arithmetic. And granted, that is extremely important. But there's also the need to focus on the whole child concept of education. And that is, if you can't incentivize a child to do well in the classroom, then you're not going to meet your student achievement goals for that child or his peers. So reading, writing, and arithmetic is the engine that drives public education. But there's the ignition system of extracurricular activities. There's the fuel system of great teachers and great programs in our schools. Those things are just as important. So I'm really proud that we focused on not only reading, writing, and arithmetic, but valuing the whole child and making that a community priority. And finally, I'm very proud of kind of putting my actions where my mouth is. I feel very strongly and passionately about public education. So I was not only part of fixing some of what is broken in public education, but also in defending public ed. There has been an extensive amount of bashing of public education in recent years, and I find that very sad. We celebrate tomorrow our Independence Day on this country, 238 years of independence. And that independence has been maintained because of our priority for public education. Our folks in the military are primarily publicly educated. Our folks that stand at the ready, whether it's police, fire, wherever, those folks are 95% of them publicly educated. So that is the backbone of this great country. And if we fail to appreciate what public education has done, then we'll so demoralize it that it won't get better, it will get worse. So I'm very, very proud of my participation in that process.
And, of course, like with anything else, we thank you for your service, because there are people out there. Everybody has an opinion, and everyone should at some point, because either you have someone that's in the SCIS system that's going to school, or you're paying for it through your taxes. So, of course, people are going to care about education. And it impacts us all. I mean, it's not just about whether or not you have a child there. It's also, if you're an employer, it's the talent gap and the workforce and all of those types of issues, and trying to make sure that you have pathways. You brought up some interesting comments, obviously, you know, with execution and the whole child, and of course, walking the talk and making sure that you can do your best when you're in that capacity. It reminds me of the STEM focus that we all have right now. And STEM, for those who don't know, is science, technology, you know, engineering, and math. And, of course, some of the blowback from that is, well, you're focusing too much on one side and you're not focusing on the creative and the artistic side. And we don't want to, you know, you don't want to have a heavy left hand or a heavy right hand. You want to have a whole child. And that's some of what you were saying. And, of course, in response to that, there are a lot of educational institutions that are putting in STEAM, so or art, you know. You know, so there's certainly some validity to that, and left brain, right brain lateralization, and making sure that our children are well developed. And then, of course, here's a question I have for you with respect to education and Supreme Court. There was just a recent decision that came down regarding tenure, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and people out there.
That was a very interesting decision.
What are your thoughts about that?
You know, teachers generally work hard, and I'm very proud of the great teachers that we have in our district, across the state, across the country. But there is a sense of entitlement amongst some teachers that they're entitled to the job that they have. And so I think that the ruling on tenure, while I'm not sure it's going to survive appeals, I think it raises a very interesting and important question as to whether tenure or performance is the correct priority for retaining teachers. Here in South Kitsap, last year, we had a budget, some would call it a budget crisis. We had a budget crunch. We were overstaffed for the amount of funding that we get from the state for our teachers, and we had to cut back. We, by contract, could not cut back on the lowest performing teachers. Tenure was the first priority and cutback. And that, to me, does not ring true to what we would do anywhere else in terms of you keep your best performers. You keep those that are doing the very best work in the classroom, and you let those that are the worst performers go. But that's not the way the system works. So I have some sympathy for that decision. Unfortunately, I do have concerns as to whether or not it will survive appeal, because it kind of undermined the whole process there. But the process does need improvement, and I wish that our state legislature would pay attention to that and make it easier for school districts to remove that from the 295 contracts across the state of Washington, certificated teacher contracts, so that we could say tenure is second to performance. And I think, you know, on balance, a teacher with 15 years of experience that is as great a teacher as a teacher with five, we're going to keep that teacher with 15 years. But if that teacher
Absolutely.
With 5 years of experience is a better teacher, is helping our students succeed better, I want to retain that 5-year teacher. And quite frankly, I don't care if that 5-year teacher is 25 years old or 65 years old. If they've only got 5 years of teaching experience and they're doing the best in the classroom, I want them there. And I want mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
And I told our superintendent this once when we first hired Dave LaRose. My first conversation with him was, Dave, I want South Kitsap to be the district where great teachers want to flock here because of the great things we're doing for kids and because they're so enthusiastic about education and teaching kids. And I want us to be such a great district that mediocre teachers are so uncomfortable that they'll go find a job in another district. And we'll help them with that.
Good luck with that one.
Yeah. But our contracts drive part of the problem of having to retain mediocre teachers over exceptional teachers. And when we had to let go some very exceptional teachers last year, it broke my heart. And those kids know who those great teachers are. And quite frankly, in talking with many of those kids, they know that the great teachers are the ones that have high expectations for them and who don't let them slide.
And, you know, to be fair, I mean, I think also that we're going to face a significant challenge in terms of an appeal and fighting that decision. And in the private sector, the last hired, first fired is not unusual. I mean, it happens. I mean, and that's one of the things
right.
that any business that's trying to have some level of continuity, that's what they're going to do, because it's very difficult when you have someone that you've just brought through the door. It's very difficult to determine whether or not they're really going to sustain whatever they're contributing and their performance and whether or not they're really going to be an asset to their organization. So it's not just that people are actually pushing back against. It is the fact that there's this big maze that's in place to keep people that are tenured that are underperforming and making it so much more difficult to get them out of the system when they should be removed. And that's really what people are pushing back. And sometimes it's just about a message. Going back to some of the things where you mentioned execution and the whole child and walking the talk in terms of your tenure as a board director, are there any things you wish you'd done differently?
I really wish that I had pressed our legislators harder, especially in regard to what eventually became the McCleary decision. The McCleary decision started in 2007. South Kitsap backed that push from the beginning, in part through my drive on that and another school board member's drive on that. We wanted to be a part of that because the state was not fulfilling its responsibility to basic ed funding. But the McCleary decision started in 2007, will hopefully resolve itself in 2018 when the legislature promises that they will, by that time, get to full funding basic education. The problem is a whole generation of our kids will go through our system in that time. And in parallel to that, in terms of my personal frustration and disappointment, is No Child Left Behind. We've been advocating for the fixes to No Child Left Behind since the second year I got on the school board, and that would have been 2006.
Mm-hmm.
We knew there were issues with that. Both parties in Washington, D.C. know that there are issues with that. And no one will step up and reach across the aisle to fix those problems. And I'm not blaming just the president. I'm not blaming just the Republicans or just the Democrats in Congress. But all of them need to grow up, sit at the table together, and work this out. And until they do, our kids will suffer through the continued push that we're failing in our schools, because it's giving a false impression that we're failing in our schools. And that's not what's happening. Public education is succeeding. It is doing great things on the whole. There are pockets of what I would consider travesty, and some of those are in highly urban areas. None of those are in Washington State. There are a couple of small pockets where we need to be deeply concerned in Washington State. But on the whole, public education is doing a solid job. Are there problems? Absolutely. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. But it needs our support, and it needs us to quit bashing those that are serving in the public sector for public ed. I feel really bad for the great teachers that we have, and most of them are really good or really great teachers. who are just demoralized by these constant bashes of public education.
Well, it's one of those things where there are so many different statistics out there, and you can argue back and forth all day, and you can look at the numbers from the Washington State perspective. You can look at them from a national perspective and how we're doing compared to other nations. And, you know, we can tweak the numbers any way we want, but the bottom line is that at the end of the day, there are definitely some areas in which we could improve the value and the quality of our public education. And I just think that's one of those things that we have to face as a real fact and start figuring out how to do that. Now, the other side of it in terms of funding, what's changing right now at a tremendous pace right now is the face of education and what it looks like. And, you know, there are a lot of online educational opportunities. There's Khan Academy, and it's shifting. People that are going into universities are looking at other options because it's become so – it's almost cost prohibitive for them. And reasons behind that don't have anything to do with improving the quality of education. It's really something that has become a moneymaker. And so I think that in some ways the McCleary decision has, you know, once again, it has brought a problem to the fore, but it has also done what happens in the private sector when something goes wrong, is it drives innovation and it drives innovative models, and it compels other people around the education space to create something that's different, that may ultimately be more efficient and effective cost-wise and otherwise for our student body population.
The opportunity for public school districts and educators in the public sector to improve the quality of education through full funding, their opportunities for innovation, for taking education to the next level, are immense. The struggle with that is we are struggling so much fiscally right now that just to get the technology into our classrooms and to keep class sizes down low enough where there is that opportunity for impact with every child every day is a tough battle. Now, one thing I will say to that, too, and I just want to plug this as something that I feel is incredibly important in public ed. Class size is not the most significant indicator of whether or not a classroom is going to be successful and children in that classroom are going to be successful. A class size of 20 with a mediocre teacher is going to produce a mediocre result. Class size of 30 with an exceptional teacher is going to produce exceptional results. So while class size is important because we want that teacher to have opportunity with every child every day, class size in and of itself, is research is showing, is not the big change element in public ed. It is the quality and the enthusiasm of that teacher in the classroom every day.
And both of those are going to ultimately be important, because you don't want an exceptional teacher in there with 30 students, because over time it's just impossible to reach every one of them, and that bleeds into stress and dissatisfaction and so forth. So to be fair, they're both very important, obviously. Now let's switch gears here for a little bit with you and take a more personal turn in our discussion, and we knew this was going to happen, so let's get ready. Now, you recently had a life-changing experience with inflammatory breast cancer, also referred to as IBC, and you're coming up actually in the next month in your one-year anniversary with that. So you want to share a short backstory on that and what happened with you?
Sure. Last summer, my youngest child graduated from high school, and we were all looking forward to new adventures and just enjoying the summer, and about mid-July, I had a small rash on my left breast and didn't think too much of it. I'm a bigger person, and, you know, summer heat, you know, a rash was small, it's not a big deal. It didn't go away in a couple weeks. And then, quite frankly, what happened was what prompted me to go just make sure that it wasn't cancer, or try to make sure it wasn't cancer, was my son's baseball coach, Anton, went in for what he thought was a bladder infection with his doctor, and it turned out he had a very serious cancer. Mm-hmm. And he started treatment immediately. And so I didn't want to worry the rest of my summer and fall, because I love the fall, about whether or not this was cancer. So I scheduled an appointment with my doctor pretty quickly, and I said, you know, I just want to be sure that this isn't cancer. He he felt, you know, pretty confident. He'd never seen cancer, breast cancer manifest that way. So he said, oh, I'm pretty sure it's not cancer. Here's some antibiotics. And since you haven't had a mammogram, we'll get you a mammogram in a few weeks. I said, you know, I really don't want to wait a few weeks. Can we just get it done so I don't have to worry? So just make shorten up the story a little bit. The next day I got into the Carol Milgard Breast Center in Tacoma for what I thought would be a routine mammogram, let my fears go and enjoy the rest of my summer, and that started the chain of events. I was that day diagnosed with, the testing was done. They were pretty sure what they were seeing, but it was inflammatory breast cancer. The biopsies confirmed that the next week. By the end of that week, I think I had a port in for infusions, and the week after that I was starting chemotherapy. And, boy, you talk about, you know, life crashing abruptly. It was pretty terrifying. So I'll get back to the being terrified in a second, but the treatment plan was chemotherapy for about 4.5 months, and then surgery, double mastectomy, and then radiation for 6 weeks after that. Every day for 6 weeks. And getting a little ahead of the game here, the really good news is I've been very, very fortunate to have been scanned in April, and they can't find any evidence of the disease. So doing really well.
That's great,
really
news. Great news.
Yeah, but I'll share with you a little bit about, you know, the journey there. It was really scary at first, and it only got scarier with chemotherapy. I'll share for your audience. I think I've told you this story, but I went in for my first chemo treatment, and I was so terrified. They put the blood pressure cuff on me, and it was up 160 over something, which is way high for me. And I ripped the cuff off and ran out of the room. And, you know, they were about to inject me with all this stuff, and my blood pressure was already sky high, and, you know, life was just coming at me way too fast. So I ran out of the room and went outside and caught some air, breathed real deep. And what's held me together for, you know, this 10, 11 months is my two kids. Well, my daughter was sitting back in the chemo room, great kid that she is. She was sitting there, and the nurse turned to her and asked her, is she coming back? And my daughter just didn't miss a Simpson beat. She says, well, she has to. I have her car keys.
There you go.
And so, you know, a few minutes later, I did come back, and we started the chemo. And I think within a half an hour or so, I was pretty comfortable that I wasn't going to die that day.
Exactly,
and,
right.
Yeah, and we went from there, and truth be told, I mean, people say it, but it's really the way it is when you're a cancer patient. It's day by day. You're grateful for every breath you take and every opportunity you have to hug your kids and share in their small successes and larger successes in life.
It's certainly that way anyway, but I can tell you that, you know, it really becomes more poignant when you're dealing with something like that. It is absolutely true. Just happens to be that I went for my exam this morning. I mean, I didn't know anything about having this show or having you on the show when I made that appointment, so it was just an irony this morning when I went. But, you know, the question that I wanted to ask you, and we were starting to get to that, what was the most difficult or challenging part, aside, obviously, from battling the cancer itself?
You know, it was scaring my kids. It was, that was really, really hard. I've always been very honest, and I talk to my kids, and we have a good relationship, I think. You might want to ask them on different days, but sitting down and telling them that night was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And
I can imagine.
They both, one is 19 and one is 22, and they both reacted very differently at the same. One completely shut down, was so terrified by it. The other got very angry at me for not telling him sooner. And I was kind of like, you know, son, I found out at 5, we're sitting here at 8. It's kind of, you know, it's about as soon as I could handle that conversation.
Absolutely,
but
right.
To their credit and to anybody listening who might have this same challenge, told them how much I loved them and how much, you know, I needed them during this time, and then gave them some breathing room so that they could process what was happening. And kids process with their friends, and so I had to give them a little bit of space. My daughter came back a little bit quicker than my son, and, you know, a few hours later she had kind of calmed down and was thinking more rationally, and had talked with her friends and realized that I wasn't going to die tomorrow.
Right,
and,
right.
And we had an opportunity to talk a little bit, and after that she was just a rock, and she decided, and I think she coerced her brother into it, that I would not go to chemo alone. I wouldn't let anybody else go to chemo, but I couldn't say no to my kids. And so they came with me to every chemo session. My son Tom, bless his heart, he came up to me a couple days after, you know, we all found this out. And he had had plans to go off to school in Spokane, and then he had changed those plans a couple weeks before we found this out, just on what he wanted to do. And I was struggling with that a little bit, and he just came to me and he said, you know, Mom, God had a plan, and I could not have been my best self 6 hours away, wondering how you were, wondering if you were lying to me about how you were doing, and, you know, being worried. He said, being here and being in Tacoma, he goes to Tacoma Community College, go Titans. being here, he was able to see every day that I was okay, and when I had bad days, he was there to give me a hug and to let me know things were going to be okay. And so things just worked out.
How has your life changed since this experience? Now, I know you're doing, you know, you've always kayaked, I believe. And so I don't know if you've always done it, then you're just you picked it up more as you started to deal with this issue. And then you're also looking at doing a triathlon. You're kind of working on that. So what are some of the one or two big highlights that have come out of this experience for you?
So I've been kayaking for the past 5 or 6 years, and, you know, I choose kayaking now because it gets me out, it gets me away from everything. Most of the time the cell phone doesn't even work, which is really hard for me, but I try anyway. And the triathlon was, back when this came down, one of the things the doctor said, no one can tell me specifically why or how I got cancer. Certainly in certain risk groups, like everybody's in certain risk groups, I'm overweight, and cancer hides in fatty tissue. And so one of the things I don't want anymore is fatty tissue. So one of my buddies challenged me to at least take on the triathlon, and I thought about that for a little bit and said, okay, I'll give that a try. And so I only have two goals for the triathlon. It's the Tri-Turtle Tryout in September. And the first one is to just finish, you know. And the second one is to not finish last. So I think my friends have kind of planned to have somebody right there, you know, that'll wait for me, and so I won't finish last. But, you know, in terms of what's changed for me, the most significant thing is valuing time.
I guess they've told us that we're out of time here. Wow, I mean, we could go on and talk. We have to make a longer show here. Well, I mean, I was going to say something about, you know, making sure that we have our signs and symptoms in check and whatever, but I'll just go ahead and thank you for joining us, Catherine, and thanks to everyone for tuning in. This live broadcast can now be found as a podcast on our talk radio site. And you can join us on Facebook at Straight Talk Radio, straight is STR and the number 8, for information about upcoming shows and other news and happening. This is your host, Tonya Keating, signing off at 3:30 Pacific Time, Thursday, July 3rd. Have a great evening, Seattle, and enjoy your Independence Day weekend. I guess we'll see you at the next show. And, Catherine, thank you so much again.
Thanks for having me.